Doc, I think she's crashing out.
This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello and welcome to WGTD's Education Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, and I'm very excited to let you know that my guests this week are Donna Hewitt and Amy Bowdersey of the Music Department at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Both Amy and Donna have been part of the department for some time now, and they've done some amazing work in making music education more relevant and more supportive to the 21st century student. They're going to tell you all about that in the next 40 minutes or so. Let me give you a little bit of a bio for each of these folks, starting with Professor Donna Hewitt. She serves as chair of the music department and coordinator of music education at the UWP. She has 13 years of public school teaching experience and currently teaches pre-service educators through courses such as music teaching and learning, general music methods, and interdisciplinary teaching and learning. Her research interests center on professional development and popular music education, and she has publications in Music Educators Journal, Visions of Research in Music Education, and the Journal of Popular Music Education. Donna has also presented at conferences on the topics of social justice and activism in music education. More recently, she co-facilitates a two-week-long professional development for all university faculty and staff on creating an anti-racist classroom through teaching and learning. So that's Donna Hewitt. Welcome. Our second guest, Amy Bowdersey, is an associate professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside who teaches private voice and directing the contemporary a cappella ensemble Parkside Range. Amy Bowdersey has performed in southeastern Wisconsin in regional companies and festivals and in Italy and Spain. Singing awards have been received by regional, national, and international organizations. Recently, Professor Bowdersey received the Chancellor and Provost's Award at the 2023 UW Parkside Assessment Showcase for her poster presentation on the Well-Being Initiative, which she's going to be telling us about. She received voice and opera theater performance degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Carnegie Mellon University, respectively. In addition, Amy earned Level 3 certification in Jean Lavetri's Somatic Voice Work, which featured contemporary commercial music vocal pedagogical technique at Shenandoah University. In 2021, Ms. Bowdersey graduated from Emerson College with a Communication Sciences and Disorders Master of Science degree and is now a licensed speech-language pathologist providing rehabilitative, affirmative, and enhancement voice care services. Wow. So welcome, Amy and Donna. This is going to be a great conversation, I know. So let's dig right in. Our first topic is what you are doing with popular music and why you gravitated towards popular music as an important area for teaching and learning. Donna, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. Thank you so much for that great introduction, Jonathan, and thank you for having us on this podcast. Looking forward to our future conversation. So to answer your question, why popular music and how did I get started? So like I think many popular musicians out there, I got started in a more informal kind of realm. I gravitated towards it throughout my childhood. I always enjoyed popular music. I didn't really take formal music lessons, except, I mean, if you want to count when I was in second grade, my family decided to take music lessons as a family at the local mall. So once a week, we would go take keyboard lessons together. And, you know, I recall playing the song Fame on the keyboard in front of the audience. And
that's great.
So fast forward to, you know, when I was in high school, I fell in love with the piano and I decided to teach myself how to play piano. So I did some of the more traditional things like for Elise, but I also did things like Bohemian Rhapsody, the whole song, and, you know, things like that. So I always had a an enjoyment of popular music. You know, fast forward to I decided to become a music major in college, and I had a little bit of a culture shock. And, you know, I experienced what many music majors in higher education experience at the undergraduate level, where the curriculum tends to be dominated by Western European classical music. So, which is fantastic. However, it is not all that is out there. So, I did most of the repertoire that was done in a Western classical European style. And then fast forward to me being a music teacher in the school system. I taught in the school system for 13 years, elementary general music. And, you know, I just did what I was kind of taught to do in higher education. So I tried to instill a love of classical music in my students. And we sang a lot of folk songs and things like that, but we didn't really do popular music because I always was like, oh, well, it's something they get at home. They don't need that here. They don't need me to do that in the classroom. So one day I noticed my students in the cafeteria singing a Black Eyed Peas song at the top of their lungs. They knew all the words. They were so enthusiastic, just singing their hearts out. And I thought, I'm missing something. So, you know, that kind of translated into when I decided to go get my PhD, one of my areas that I chose to focus on was popular music education and how that has really just positively impacted students' lives and validated their interests and, you know, helped with even retention in music programs, and it helped with teacher burnout. I mean, there was a research study that was done in called Musical Futures. It was really, you know, just has done wonderful things. And I thought, aha, this is the validation that I was looking. So it kind of connected my past with my present. So hopefully that's in a nutshell why popular music and how I gravitated towards that.
Sure. Very interesting. Thank you. And how about you, Amy?
Yeah. So I'm a child of the 70s, and I have to say that there was just such great music out there in that era, right? Yes. And I was exposed to, you know, really a lot of diverse music as a child with, you know, the more popular styles. And then my older brother and sister did, you know, band and choir and more formal formal programs through their, you know, their schooling. And I just always was singing. And so that's kind of why I ended up focusing more on that, although I did play the flute as well and did marching band and the whole thing. And my voice was more, I guess it always was more naturally at its home in classical music. Even in elementary school, my teacher said, oh, I think you could be an opera singer someday. And I remember running home and telling my mom, and she laughed. I was in, I think, fifth grade at the time. But then, you know, there was a point where I was in junior high, which is now considered middle school, when I wanted to learn how to belt. I wanted to be able to sing, you know, Tomorrow from Annie, right? Like, it was a big, big hot thing at the time. And no one, like, there was a voice teacher that I went to, and that person, you know, said, well, we're going to do this one instead. And there really weren't, you know, anybody around at that time that could teach me how to do something a little bit more, I guess, quote unquote, modern in a sense, right? And so I just stuck with classical. But then in high school, I became really good friends with a band, the bandmates in a band, and I started to listen to their music, and I went to a lot of concerts. I went to Alpine Valley many times. I saw Boston, Pink Floyd, Rush, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, George Harrison. Anyway, lots of great artists, and just fell in love with the, you know, all of that type of music. And I'm quoted in my high school yearbook as saying, I would love to be a backup singer for Pink Floyd someday.
Fantastic.
And the solo from Great Gig in the Sky.
Exactly. Yes. I love it. But, you know, again, my voice was just always more lended, you know, it lended itself more so to the classical genre. So I went to school for that. And as Donna had mentioned, my formal program in undergraduate was all pretty much, we really just did, you know, Western classical music. In my, all my years there, I think I did a musical theater piece in my studio lessons, maybe twice, maybe even once, I'm not sure, but it was pretty much just all classical, and we didn't like veer from that. And that's not bad. I love classical, and it's still, I think, where my home likes, or my voice likes to live. It's its home. But I started to kind of question, like, you know, how can I kind of dip my toe into that? And my very first private voice student when I was a senior in college was in a band. And he said, oh, I want lessons. And I was like, oh, my goodness. Okay. And it was, you know, more of a casual thing. But I realized at that point already that, oh, boy, I, you know, I can help him with some things. I mean, obviously breathing, you know, what's going on anatomy wise, that sort of thing when you sing. But in terms of shifting his, you know, my way of thinking, I guess, of teaching to what I learned, it didn't really, you know, it didn't really mesh with what he wanted to sing. And so anyway, fast forward to much later when I became a professor at Parkside, my students would come in and the focus was mainly classical, but I had some people come in that naturally could belt. They just, you know, they could do it. They just felt at home in that style. And I would always tell them, okay, I'm not formally trained in pedagogy to teach somebody to belt, but if you can come in and, you know, you're already belting, I can help you with, you know, again, like making sure the voice is on the breath, on the support, you know, healthy, that sort of thing.
Yes.
But I knew that I needed more training. So then I went to a series of workshops with Jeannie Lavetri, as you mentioned in my bio, and that's where I became trained in how to work with a voice in terms of learning how to sing more in a contemporary way. I was the brave soul that volunteered among, I don't know how many of us were there, maybe 100 voice teachers in the room that said, yeah, I'm the one that, you know, my voice just doesn't belt. It just doesn't do that, you know, and I don't think I ever can do it. And she said, perfect, come on up here. She had me belting in 10 minutes. I was like, what is happening? I didn't even know my voice could do that, right? And so that was really exciting. I then went to LA and I worked with a woman there who, Sting is on her wall. She worked with the Belle from Beauty and the Beast. So I also learned like a little bit of her technique in terms of belting. And again, she had me belting right away. And she's like, oh, you actually have a pretty good belt voice. I'm like, really? You know, I still don't really do that much, like, you know, in terms of my regular singing right now. But to know that I can do it gave me that confidence as a teacher that I could teach others to do it. And it's all, you know, it's sets of muscles and things that are happening that you just need to shift. But in any case, at the Lavetri training, she told all of us in the room that most of us being, you know, mostly classically trained and focusing on that, she said, if any of you teach at a university, you should go back and talk to your, you know, your cohorts and suggest adding a more contemporary track to what you do, because that's the future. And I did. I came back and the faculty said, okay, maybe, yeah. And so I put the bug in their ear, and that was probably in around 2010. And then in 2016 was when we formally went forth with this new track of contemporary commercial music.
The Contemporary Commercial Music Concentration. And just a little bit from the catalog. For voice students focusing on contemporary styles of singing, this concentration provides vocal training in various vocal genres, including jazz, pop, rock, musical theater, and more. Additional coursework will be provided in improvisation, sound production, and contemporary commercial music-focused ensembles. That's a start, yes?
Definitely.
Would you like to say more about it?
Sure. Well, what's really exciting is to say that now we offer an instrumental track as well that's brand new. So we're really excited about that. And we had our first students enrolled in that this year. And basically, the contemporary commercial music track is something that the students will audition for to get into formally a little bit later on in their music study, because the first couple years of study, at least how we currently have the program, it's the same for everybody, no matter if they're, you know, wanting to do music education or classical focus performance, jazz, or contemporary commercial focus. Mm-hmm. And one of the wonderful things is that the students really get to experience all the styles. So it's not that they completely avoid classical, because they will be studying classical music as well. But they'll also be getting to do the other genres that suit them, and some will suit them better than others. Again, everybody's voice, I feel like, has a home they like to live in, and then they may be able to visit other places, and some places maybe not visited very often, but you know, they learn how best to sing in those styles. So yeah, it's really exciting. We have Parkside Range is the contemporary commercial music ensemble for the voice students. And then we are newly offering the contemporary commercial ensemble for instrumentalists. And so I don't know if Donna, you want to like chat a little bit about that.
Well, you know, it's kind of newly formed. We just, you know, we're so excited. We have a colleague coming in. His name's Professor Ayisu Lardi, that's going to be joining us and heading up that aspect of things, and has just such amazing expertise within that field. And I'm just so excited for what's coming our way with our students. And, you know, I wanted to just add that, you know, how just really special the contemporary commercial music program is. You know, as I alluded to when I was talking at the beginning, it's not often that students who go to higher education to be a music major, it's not often that they see the music that they wish to engage with reflected in the curriculum. And, you know, there's this idea of, you know, the window and the mirror. You know, you want to have a curriculum where you see your students, they're reflected in the curriculum, which is, you know, the mirror. And then, you know, the window is the new things that they're experienced to. I think a lot of times, sometimes all we do is focus on what the new is rather than, you know, having them really just validated in the music that they love and they want to explore, and even the genres in which they want to compose in, sing, the styles they wish to sing in. So, you know, really kudos to Amy for starting this program at our university. And there, it's not a common thing. It's getting more, it's, you know, getting more widely accepted, but it's still not the norm.
Right. I remember way back in the 1970s when I was in high school, you might have, as I did, an extraordinary human being, a music teacher who taught a special ensemble after hours and brought 20 of us together to sing both madrigals and contemporary music. And it was such a joyous experience. And we felt that we were expressing ourselves personally, and we were bonding as an ensemble, but that also we were demonstrating excellence, and we loved the classical pieces. It all somehow fit together. Is that part of what you're trying to cultivate in this program, is a sense that there's not a fundamental disconnect between classical and more popular forms?
Yeah, I think it gets rid of the hierarchy, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, for the longest time, classical music was seen as the end-all be-all of, you know, musical excellence, the art song, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, as I said before, it's beautiful, it's a wonderful thing, but it is not the only thing, you know, and it doesn't speak to everybody. So mm-hmm. the fact that we have more diversity there with, you know, accepting of genres and the people who have created those genres, I think is a really, really important thing. Amy, did you want to chime in on that? I saw your head was nodding a little bit on that one.
Yeah, sure. You know, and I think when you think about popular shows right now, for example, Bridgerton, where they'll take a popular piece and they score it so that it's played by classical instruments, you know, so there's a lot more of this kind of melding, meshing, you know, molding this, you know, a piece of today that's really unique, but it also kind of has both aspects to it. And also the popular music, a lot of it, you know, really is influenced by other things. And I think, and sometimes vice versa. And so I think it's important for the students to kind of understand where things came from, you know, and that gives them a perspective of where things are today. So when I teach my pop rock history class, you know, we start like at about the Tin Pan Alley era, and then we go through to today, and it's really eye-opening for them, you know, and there's so many topics, and that could be a whole other episode.
That's a whole other, yeah. Other podcast.
Let me ask you both a silly question. Maybe it's not silly. Is it true to say that some of the popular music of today will be the classical music of tomorrow? Was Mozart's music the popular music of his day? I know he wrote for an elite. He wrote for the court. So maybe not. But I'm just... Sometimes it gets thrown out. You know. They were the popular music of their day.
Well, you know, I think at that time, you know, just based on... Well, for example, technology in and of itself, right? The electric guitar isn't really that old when you compare it to a violin. And I think when you think about those, you know, historical composers and eras, you know, like Mozart in the classical era, they didn't have TV, they didn't have radio. That was their form of entertainment. So
everyone had pianos in the homes. That's what they did, gather around the piano.
Yes, and that's all, in the salon, and have, you know, our leader sung, you know. And so I think at that time, I mean, I would love to go back in time. It'd be so great to just take a sneak peek at that. But I feel like that was their popular music, but that was also the classical music, but because that's what we see it as now, right? And so, you know, historians have figured out like, oh, this was this era, you know, and then... Because we have popular music, then we have something called classical music. But I do feel at that time that was the popular music. And I often wonder, Jonathan, what would Mozart say? You know, when I hear something or see something, I'm like, I want to be like that.
Might like that. I mean, come on, Stephen Sondheim? Wow.
Brilliant. Yeah.
You know, Jonathan, I'm also thinking, you know, if you notice, if you listen to the radio, sometimes when they're like, oh, we're going to listen to like, you know, the classics or whatever, you're hearing 80s. Sometimes 90s.
Oh yeah, the classics.
You know, and I'm like, really?
Right.
So I think there is a certain level of truth that will come of that. Like, you know, when I'm, you know, in my retirement home, you know, the oldies that I want to listen to, you know, are probably going to be something from the 80s, 90s, who knows.
Well, you know, Amy and I know that the true classics are from the 70s, but we can debate that another time.
I'm totally on board with it. It's all good. It's all good.
I need to do a station identification. This is WGTD-FM. We are listening to Education Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler. And my guests today are Donna Hewitt and Amy Bowdersey of the Music Department at UW Parkside. And we're having a wonderful conversation about music and music education and making it relevant and supportive of the 21st century student. We're going to do a pivot now. We've just been talking about popular music and making that a concentration within the curriculum, making that a focus. Now we're going to look at making education relevant to a diverse student body. And I know that, Donna, you've been helping to teach something known as the Summer Institute. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. Before I kind of tell you a little bit about it, I think, you know, some perhaps background and grounding information might be useful. So, you know, UW Parkside, often part of our identity is we say we're the most diverse institution in the UW system. And part of our mission statement is our commitment to serving our diverse student population. So a lot of our initiatives that we have are geared towards that mission statement. So, you know, our local student body, what's unique about southeastern Wisconsin, and we serve Racine and Kenosha, it tends to be very diverse. And so with that recognition, we want to make sure that our curriculum, our offerings, what we're doing as an institution is supporting that diverse student population. So Summer Institute is a 2-week professional development for faculty and staff. And we tend to have themes for each week. So our first week that we'll have tends to center on getting to know our students. So we'll do different things. We have readings throughout to prompt our thinking. We have various guests. So we'll do things like we'll have someone come in and talk about a chapter that they wrote. Damien Evans wrote a chapter called A Sense of Not Belonging. So he wrote about his experience as an African-American student previously at Parkside and what that kind of felt like for him. You know, all this to say that we are trying to, at the end of the day, cultivate a sense of belonging for everyone, because we want our students to succeed. We want to increase our graduation rate, particularly for our students that are historically underserved. So kind of going back to that, we do things like we'll invite our Office of Institutional Research to come in so we can analyze our DFW rates for our classes and look to see what's going on there and see how we can best support our students.
Could you break down that acronym DFW rates?
Sure. It's the rate at that your students have achieved D's, F's, or W's withdraws within your class. So thank you for asking me to clarify that. So we do that, and then our second week is based off of getting to know who you are as a human being. So we kind of talk about how you intersect with these ideas, because we focus on race, you know, predominantly, but we do also talk about other intersectionalities. So we really kind of examine where are we coming from, where have we gotten some of these ideas about academia, about other people that are not like us, that lead to some things that we might not consciously, you know, be aware of within our classroom. So it's really a great two-week intensive time to kind of explore some of these ideas and how we can best facilitate that. One thing that I'd like to clarify, so I'm not the lead, like, I'm not necessarily spearheading this. It was actually... Okay. Yeah, so it started in 2007, you know, and it ran through 2010. I am a co-facilitator, and that's important because, you know, I can only bring my lived experience to the workshop, to the institute. So I have two other fabulous co-facilitators that join me, Trina Patterson, DeAndre Taylor, that share their experiences and help our participants, because otherwise it would just be through my own particular lens, which is a white lens. So if we're looking at, you know, how can we support diverse efforts, we want to make sure that we have diverse voices at the table.
Can you point to an example or an experience either that you've had or that one of your instructors has had? And of course, Amy's going to join this conversation as well, so this could be to Amy as well, where you could see where this really matters, this consciousness of intersectionality or this... focus on inclusion, this broadening of horizons, or accounting for both the limits and affordances of one's own upbringing and one's perspective. Where have you seen it really hit the road, so to speak?
You know, that's a really great question. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I can talk about my own experience. So I went through Summer Institute when I joined Parkside. So I went through the summer of 2019. And, you know, the Institute has had different co-facilitators and they focus on different things. So at the time that I went through, we were focused on having an innovative, some kind of innovation we were going to do in the classroom. And mine was a research study. So I decided to do a research study on a student sense of belonging within the world music gen ed that I was teaching at the time. And what I came away with was, I came away with valuable information, and there was an increase in sense of belonging with the students that were non-music majors within the class that came as a result of that study. And I remember sharing those results with my colleagues back when we all reconvened to talk, my cohort of Summer Institute. And I kind of like thought about it, and you know, I remember Damien saying to me, he kind of looked at me and he's like, it's not enough. You know, and I was like, what do you mean it's not enough, Damien? I just did this whole research study and everything. And, you know, when you kind of like bottom line it, when you look at the data, when you look at, you know, who's being served, who's not being served, where are students increasing their rates of graduation? Where are students, you know, not you know, increase, which for us at Parkside has been African Americans and our Hispanic population as well. And when I kind of think about that, I think that kind of, for me, puts the bullseye more closer to center. You know, what can I do, you know, as Donna Hewitt at UW Parkside to help support that? And now as, you know, chair of the music department, what can I do to help support that as well? To kind of, sometimes I think we get a little lost in some of the periphery of things. So for me personally, one of the ways that I've decided to, you know, help that is in, you know, stepping up and being one of the co-facilitators of this institute and helping, you know, my other colleagues, what can they do to support students and using the data to help ground that as well. So I hope that answered your question. It wasn't too random.
it's on the way, but I want to repeat my question and maybe frame it a little more strongly. And again, this is to both of you. So incorporating what you just said, Donna, which is was helpful because it, what it points to is a key indicator of success is graduation, improving graduation rates.
And retention.
And retention rates of historically underserved populations, so African American, Latino, Latina. And the question I have then is, what does that look like from the on a given day, from the perspective of an instructor teaching a class at 9 a.m. in music or reading papers later that afternoon and deciding how to respond to them. In terms of a practice, where do we see some traction with this idea that we're going to be doing something different?
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for reframing that.
Sure.
So I think as some of the tangible ways that our participants have really taken to this is they will make sure they'll look at their materials of their courses and they'll make sure that their resources, their texts that they're using, their supplemental materials, any videos, things like that are diverse. They come from diverse voices and not, you know, some simply through a white lens. I think another thing they'll do, you know, we focus on seeing the humanity in everyone. So I think that kind of translates through interrogating your own perspective of your student. Are you seeing them through a deficit perspective? Meaning, do you only see them for what they lack? You know, oh, this student's always late. Oh, this student always hands in their work, you know, late, or they don't hand it in at all. So can we see the humanness of our students, ourselves, and our colleagues? And really understand, okay, well, why is that? Maybe they are working an overnight shift and not getting any sleep, or perhaps they have caregiving responsibilities at home. Or perhaps they are just, you know, coming from a background where they are just not acculturated to some of the expectations in higher education. Perhaps, you know, that's because that's a thing, you know? So it's really comes from an understanding your students. So all that to say, another thing that I see implemented a lot are more flexible due dates for assignments.
Okay.
So that's another thing that I'll see. I'm wondering if maybe I should kick this over to Amy.
That was helpful, by the way. That was helpful. Yeah.
Your reframing was really helpful. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Yeah, I think to add and also to kind of draw in what we were just talking about, you know, we're now looking at, especially with our new colleague coming in, whose focus, one of his main focus points will be to restructure the music theory program. And, you know, that's something to think about with respect to this, because music theory traditionally has been taught in such a way, or the expectations have been there, in such ways that really have disallowed students to, you know, be embedded in the material, you know, and to feel like they can't succeed. And so I think with us looking at that, I'm excited to see what opportunities there will be to support our students and really tie into the work of Summer Institute as well. One of my favorite quotes from Summer Institute was by Kevin Gannon, and it is, "Neutrality is the luxury of the comfortable." So it's, you know, just be neutral isn't really doing anything. So we need to be proactive. And so digging in and seeing where we can think about, are our policies really serving our students, or mm-hmm. are they just ones that we had ourselves when we were in school, mm-hmm. and we think mm-hmm. that that's how it should be. Mm-hmm. So it's tough. I mean, it's really tough, you know, to yeah. reimagine things. But once you dig in and do the work, you really see that it's important, and it only is going to serve our students better. And really, it doesn't take anything away. You actually gain a lot.
Well, okay, so I'll play devil's advocate. I'll enter the cultural wars here and be that voice that says, so what you're really talking about is lowering standards. How do you respond to that?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
It's well, a real what, concern.
Yeah. It is yeah. a real concern.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, I can see where people get nervous about that, you know. But for me, when I started teaching online, I was in the second cohort of the online learning education at Parkside as an educator. So learning how to facilitate that, how to transform your class to become an online class. And we got to dive into, you know, what methods of learning, principles of learning, all of those things, and how we needed to really look at our courses so differently and really structure them. It was almost like a 180, you know, in a sense. And I think, I truly believe there are, and just having come out of school again myself, and that's a fresh perspective for me as well. But there are other ways to test somebody. It doesn't have to be the traditional test. When I did that online learning course and took my music appreciation course and turned it into an online course, I had to completely change my assessments. Mm-hmm. But I found that they were so much more valuable for the student as well as to myself. Mm-hmm. So something, instead of like taking just a traditional test and testing them and having them, you know, fill in blanks or mini essays or multiple choice, whatever, they had to do a bit of writing. It wasn't like, you know, a 10-page paper or anything mm-hmm. like that. But across that semester, they would write. And each time they wrote, I gave them feedback and made it in such a way that by the end of the semester, hopefully then they, you know, they were able to improve their skills, right? Mm-hmm. Because for me, that's more as an educator what I look at. Are they improving from whence they came? You know, are they improving their skills? Obviously, we have to give grades. It's mm-hmm. how it works. You know, I want them to have something that they can feel that they tangibly improved upon, you know, that they didn't just memorize something. Because, again, just coming out of school myself, we didn't have a lot of those tests like that where you just had to memorize. Mm-hmm. It was more, you know, different types of assessments that you really delved into and you really retained more. But I can tell you the tests where I did have to just memorize and, you know, fill in blanks mm-hmm. and things like that, my retention probably isn't as good as the ones where I got to delve into the material more. So I think we need to just think about ways of helping build skills versus test abilities.
Okay.
So Amy, what you're talking about is, you know, what we refer to in the field of education as authentic assessments. So rather than doing your traditional pencil and paper test, authentic assessments can be done in a multitude of ways. And you're talking about doing portfolio assignments, ways that really authentically assess the student's ability to demonstrate that kind of knowledge. So if anything, we're not necessarily dumbing down the curriculum. I forget how you phrased it, John.
Lowering standards. Yes.
Lowering standards. We are not lowering the standards. Mm-hmm. If anything, right. I would say that we're raising them a little bit more because we're providing the opportunity to more authentically engage. And, you know, in the field of education, we have this idea of, you know, Bloom's taxonomy, which is the levels that you, for learning, you know, at the very, very bottom, you have whether or not you can recall the information and, you know, and then at the very top, you have whether or not you can create the information and create. So, I mean, these are really definitely lending themselves to just better ways of our students understanding content and being able to demonstrate they understand content. You know, the book that we were referring to, Amy had the quote from Kevin Gannon. His book is Radical Hope, which was one of the centering texts that we had during Amy's cohort in Summer Institute. And, you know, I think part of the reason why it's so necessary to have this two-week intensive is we need to allow time to digest and to really do some internal kind of work on things and have space for the pushback that you're talking about, Jonathan, because that does happen as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to interrogate, where did this idea of rigor come from? Where did we learn these ideas that this is the only way that I need to assess? Mm-hmm. Where did this come from? And why are we still doing this? Does this still serve us? Does this serve our students? Mm-hmm. So I think if we really get to being student-centered, that I hope helps alleviate some of those culture wars that are going on.
Well, yeah, I think this is so well said. If you don't meet students where they are, how can there be any hope of engagement or improvement or development? You need to meet students where they are. And as Amy said, a very interesting expression, embed them in the curriculum. And I could investigate that phrase, but we're out of time. So what I want to do is give you both about a minute or so to just say what's on your mind at the conclusion of this conversation today, questions that are lingering for you that you'd like our audience to consider, perhaps thoughts that you'll carry away from this conversation.
Well, I think for me, because we didn't have time to talk about the well-being initiative, I would just like to say that that was based on finding out where our students were at and how we could best serve them. So that is my takeaway for people to think about that. How can you assess where your students are at, not just, you know, from an academic point of view, but also just, you know, mental, you know, how are they feeling? Just, are they feeling like they're being supported? And then how can, you know, you help them feel better about academics and well-being in terms of just, you know, state of mind and all of the things that go with that, emotional support and everything.
Okay, thank you for that. We have 30 seconds, Donna, for you.
Oh, geez. Ah, I think I have in my head, I'm hearing in my own little mind, know yourself and know your students. And I mm-hmm. think if you can really take the time to understand, put yourselves in their shoes with empathy and compassion, you know, think about some experiences that you've had, how you felt, and, you know, how you wanted to be treated. And then think about that for your students as well. And for others, I mean, even outside the classroom. Yeah. I think treating each other with humanity goes a really long way.
Ah, beautifully said. Thank you so much. I want to thank both of our guests today, music professors from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, Donna Hewitt and Amy Bowdersey. Thank you so much for this enlightening and engaging conversation. I hope that the conversation will continue in our community about these issues. This is Jonathan Shaler on WGTD's Education Matters. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, you are invited to enjoy a peaceful early morning paddle down the river at the River Bend Nature Center in Racine, Sunday, July 14th from 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. For more info, call 262-639-1515.
I'm Gregory Berg, and we will spend most of Monday's morning show with Scott Dorley and Carissa Carter, who teach design at Stanford University. They have co-authored a beautiful new book called Assembling Tomorrow, A Guide to Designing a Thriving Future. The book enlarges our understanding of what it means to design and how all of us are designers in one way or another, and it calls for us to be more thoughtful and more careful in our designs. Monday's morning show begins just after 8.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
In a world filled with possibilities and wonder, we can always find grace in between the music. Join me, Lily Maselli, host of In Between the Music, and enjoy trivia and music together. For dates and times, visit WGTD.org.
This is WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's hosted by Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College, Jenny Tunkeys, former reporter for the Kenosha